Welcome to Podcastville. The Church of What's Happening Now is brought to you by Squarespace. You know what things you could do with Squarespace? You could create a beautiful website. You could turn your cool idea into a website. You could showcase your work. You could blog or publish content. Listen to this one. You could sell products and services of all kinds and promote your physical or online business. You can announce upcoming events or special projects and much, much more, all right? I mean, Squarespace is where it's at when you're ready to rock. Right now, what I want you to do is go to squarespace.com for a free trial. Just take a look. When you're ready to launch your website, use offer code CHURCH. It's going to save you 10% off your first purchase of a website or domain. That's squarespace.com. Enter code CHURCH. This podcast is also brought to you by Onnit, leader in supplements. You understand me, from Shroom Tech Sport to Shroom Tech Immune to the Alpha Brain, which has a money-back guarantee. And guess what? We don't even want your fucking money back. Don't even send the stuff back. We'll just send you back the money. If Alpha Brain don't work on you, there's got to be a problem. You understand me? That's why some days I'm a mamaluke and some days I'm tip-top Magoo. It's because I'm back on the fucking Alpha Brain cycle. So go to Onnit.com right now and press in.
Church.
And get 10% off your motherfucking order. Kick this mule, Lee. Oh, shit. Monday, the 19th of March. St. Paddy's is over. Your little ha-ha time is done. It's back to business, motherfuckers. Little Uncle Joey, the Flying Jew, and my man TJ English. Here we go. What? Monday, bitches. Tip Top Magoo, get ready to go. They ain't giving out shit today. The Gilmore's guitar. What? Here we go. The band is just fantastic. What? Which one's pain? Oh shit. It's Monday morning. You ready to go? Whatever you had on your mind is fucking gone because you're ready. You're ready for the world. You got the world by the ball. If you were depressed, if you were sad, if you were having a bad day, that was yesterday. Today's today. Scrub that pussy, powder that motherfucker, and put some toenail polish on those toes and get out there, ladies. It's all over. You don't need to march. You don't need to do nothing. Just let these cocksuckers know you're running things. Lee Syatt, what's happening?
I'm doing pretty good, buddy. How you doing?
Good. No problems. Had a great weekend. I want to thank my man, the Irishman, what's his name?
TJ English?
No. The other fucking guy. Greg Fitzsimmons, who put me on the show last night. I had a great time. Just switching it up to the improv. Like we were talking about, Leo and I, you got to get out of your comfort zone. I forgot to tell you guys, this last week, I went to a meeting the other day for breakfast, and some guy goes, "Have you tried cryotherapy yet?" And, you know, I've heard it from Rogan for years and all these fucking guys. I don't think I'm a half a penguin. I don't think I could last in a fucking barrel for fucking minutes with freezing weather. But you know what? That morning I was feeling a little froggy. And I wanted to go out of my comfort zone. And I was a little sore from the day before. And I stopped. I got the free fucking thing. And I went into that cryotherapy place. It's right on Ventura and Tahunga. Let me tell you something. That shit is fucking tremendous. Whatever the fuck I was feeling when I walked in there, I did the first one, 3 minutes I lasted in there. I listened to Heaven and Hell by Black Sabbath blasting over the thing. I did jumping jacks. I couldn't do push-ups because I can't fit. I can't. I just can't do it. You can just do jumping jacks and throw punches in the air. But I got to tell you something. I don't know if I feel better or not. I'm just when I do shit like that, I'm just better. I go out of my comfort zone. Like, I don't think, like, I don't even like cold showers too much. Never mind going in a fucking cold room like that. But you know what? It was fine. I took my wife, and she chickened out as always. She tapped out after 3 minutes. The flight or fight response is too much for some people. It used to be too much for me before I joined jiu-jitsu.
But does it give you, like, when you do something that takes you out of your comfort zone, does it give you confidence? Or, like, what does it do for you?
It gives you confidence, and it lets you know that you did something. You did something. Not nobody else. Nobody else helped you with it. There's nothing like the feeling of you doing something. Like you accomplishing something that is fucking weird. And we all get set in our ways. We get fucking lazy and we do the same shit and we take the same route home. And sometimes you just have to do things outside the ordinary because you may discover something about yourself that you didn't know. That's what going out of your comfort zone is, you know? It's like when I write. I fucking hate writing. Not because you know why I'm bad at it. But I just been writing lately. And this week I'm almost finished with that fucking chapter in a book that was the shortest chapter in the book, but the longest one for me. I don't know why. It's been a fucking nightmare. But you know, every day I write like a daily journal. Every day like I write a fucking some. Every 3 days I write a letter to my daughter to explain what's going on in my life and why she's so special. So if something does happen to me, she has a journal that's dedicated just to her. You know, I always try to write. And it's funny. I don't know. I quit high school, guys. But I was always a reader. I still remember reading Jonathan Livingston Seagull. I still remember reading The World's Greatest Athlete and all these dumb books. I just like to read. I think it's part of being an only child. It's part of an escape. So when you do comedy and you go on the road, for you to, there's just so much you could do. You know, at that time, I wasn't into exercising at all in hotel rooms. I thought that was absurd, and half the hotels that they put you in those days, they're lucky if you have a shower, never mind the fucking gym. So I would read. I would go to Barnes & Noble's and spend 30 bucks on books. I had the discounts. I had the coupons. I had everything you could get in those days. And I would read, and I read a lot of fucking crime shit because when I got here in 97, I would audition for mafia roles, and I knew nothing about the roles, so I wanted to do some character shit. So I read as many mafia books as I could. I read as many Irish mafia books as I could. I read as much shit as organized crime if I could. Even the M13, whatever the fuck they are, I read a book on them. I just enjoy reading those types. Some are stupid. Some I just throw away because they're just you know, a bunch of bravado and self-bravado and shit like that. But some books, you just learn how their system and why, you know? And one of the books I read was a book about the Westies. And it was a great book. I knew half the story. I knew that there was 9 of them, and the mafia had to bow down to them and whatnot at one point because there were killers and kidnapping fucking mafia bookies and fucking...
Oh, anyway, shit.
And taking their fucking books and shit and then collecting... And one of the guys that wrote it was a guy, T.J. English. I didn't think anything of it. I didn't, you know, to be honest with you guys, I didn't even give a fuck. And then, years later, a buddy of mine, my daughter's godfather, James, called me and said to order a book, Havana Nocturne. And it really changed my life. It really gave me a clearer view of what my country was about. All the things I had heard had been confirmed and then some, you know, and how the revolution had taken over. And especially starting in this place named Union City, New Jersey. That's where my mother had the bar, and that's where, you know, I grew up part-time, and I knew a lot of people there. It's a very dear little Spanish city. I don't even know what it's like. It used to be very Cuban and very Irish and very Italian. And the more I think about it now, it was one of those neighborhoods that you see in movies like Bronx Tale and stuff like that. And I was at a party, and somebody had mentioned books, and I mentioned this Havana Nocturne, and they said they had the book on hold to maybe make a movie about it. But then I heard about another book named The Corporation, and guess who the author is? T.J. English. And I fucking emailed him, and he got back to me, and he went to one of my shows when I was at the Gotham, and We spoke a little bit, and we continued speaking on the phone. It's an interesting book, and it's getting released on the 20th. He's not here, so what I'm going to have him do is call in, and then we'll discuss what we learned afterward. Good afternoon.
Yeah, this is TJ.
¿Qué pasa, Sede?
Bien, todo bien. ¿Y tú?
Ahí jodiendo con el Julio este. I'd like to welcome to the show one of my favorite authors. I'm like a fan groupie of this guy. You know, the great writer, Mr. TJ English. Thank you very much for taking the time and calling in today, Mr. English.
Well, Joey, it's a pleasure. It's a real pleasure.
You know, I was on the road. I would go on the road. When I first got to L.A. in 97, I had a really good manager. And even though, as soon as he got me, he started sending me out for auditions. And 10% of them were for Mexican auditions, and the other 90% were for basically Italian hot dog guys, that guys, but a majority of it was for Italian gangsters. And mm-hmm. I had grown up around a few of them. I knew the mannerisms, but I didn't really know the story. So while I was on those Greyhound buses across the country, I would stop at Barnes & Noble's, buy four books, and read them in a weekend. And I came across your Westies book. And later on in my life, I dealt with a guy that said he was a Westie, and he got me a lot of side jobs. I did a lot of lookout work for him and stuff like that. So when I read the book, it, you know, it was a great book, and blah, 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 blah. You know, I was reading so many books then, TJ. And yeah. Then a friend of mine, James Villano, is married to a Cuban chick. I grew up with him and his cousins, and he called me one day and says, you got to read this book, Havana Nocturne. And I was completely overtaken. And when I looked you up right away, and I go, why would a fucking guy from Tacoma give a fuck about Cuba and write such a great and an elaborate researched book? You know, and then I go to a party, which I never go to for CAA, to watch a UFC thing. And we're talking, and I go, man, the book to read is Havana Nocturne. And he goes, I think we have that on option. And then a month later, he calls me, the same agent. He goes, hey, Benicio just signed on for TJ English's new Cuban book about where you're from, someplace in Jersey. And my head almost fucking exploded. I went to your website. I looked up the name Jose Battle. I contacted you. You were a gentleman and contacted me right back. And here we are today, 2, 3, 4, 5 months later. Why would a guy from Tacoma be so enriched with crime writing, organized crime writing?
Well, I don't know where the Tacoma comes in. You know, I left Tacoma pretty early in life.
Okay, I
grew up in a big Irish Catholic family, 10 kids. 5 girls and 5 boys. And Tacoma is one of those kind of places where you start dreaming of getting out of there as soon as you're old enough to dream. And you know, it's evolved a lot. Tacoma today is kind of an interesting place. But when I was there, it was sort of a gritty little industrial dumping ground for its more beautiful neighbor city of Seattle. So, you know, every really nice city has this ugly stepchild city next door. You know, New York has Newark, San Francisco has Oakland, Seattle had Tacoma. But it was okay. It was a good place to grow up. It was a working class place.
I did comedy there at the Continental Inn.
You did?
I used to eat a bag of dicks there. They fucking hated me.
That's too bad. Anyway, so I left there when I was like 18. I mean, I got out of there. I went to college in L.A., Loyola Marymount, little Catholic university, the Jesuits, educated by the Jesuits, and then headed east as soon as I could. I had dreamed about the big show ever since I was an adolescent, getting to New York, the big proving ground. You know, I wanted to be a writer. I had that idea from pretty early in life, was always working on school newspapers and getting lots of positive feedback on essays and things I would write in school. So like anything, you get applause, you get positive feedback, that becomes your focus. And writing did it for me. I especially liked journalism because it got me out of the house, got me out into the universe, into worlds that maybe I didn't grow up in or didn't have any knowledge of. And all I had was my curiosity and my wits. And this became a great challenge. I always saw it as a great challenge. And so I came to New York with the desire to be a writer. So, of course, what's the first thing I do? Drive a cab for 3 years. That was my New York City education.
What year was this?
What's that?
What year was this, TJ? I'm sorry to interrupt.
That was in the mid-80s. And I'm telling you, driving a cab in New York City in the mid-80s, we're talking about the heart of the crack cocaine year.
Right, 84, 85. That's when I left.
Yeah. 2,000, over 2,000 homicides a year. I mean, it was a dangerous place. And you could feel it when you're driving a cab around during those years. So this was the things that were sort of compelling me to be a writer. But, you know, Cuba and the interest in Cuba. You know, the first book, The Westies, that's an easy one. I mean, I'm Irish-American, and that was about the last of the Irish mob in New York. And so that was, I was almost writing about my own cultural experience, writing about that. Cuba always fascinated me. You know, I was born in October 57, so I'm a young kid. When Castro comes into power, and Castro and the United States at odds with each other was an item on the news every day. And I was just fascinated, more so with the relationship between the United States and Cuba. It just seemed like such a fascinating love-hate connection. And the idea that this island that was right there somehow could be the biggest nemesis to the United States, it all fascinated me, captured my imagination from a pretty young age. So I go on and become a crime writer, and I'm writing about the Irish mob. I write about a Vietnamese gang in Chinatown in New York. But in the back of my mind is the great untold story of the era of the mafia in Havana in the 1950s. You know, that story had never really been written. It had been done in Godfather Part 2, and there were a few other movies that had dealt with it. But nobody had really gone to Cuba, done the research, really got to the past, the legend and the folklore, and got to some actual truth of what happened there. So that's what led to the writing of the Havana Nocturne. And by then, I'll be honest with you, I was already in love with Cuban culture. I listened to Cuban music. I'm fascinated with a lot of things about Cuban culture. So getting to go there and do the research for that book, Havana Nocturne, was like dying and going to heaven. It was one of the greatest things I've ever had the opportunity to do research in Cuba, to spend, you know, some real time there. Just wonderful. So I, you know, then when that book was over, I wanted to do more.
TJ, hold on one question.
There was the obvious question of what happens once the mafia gets chased off the island. Do they take that lying down? What comes next? And that was what motivated me to want to write The Corporation.
Now, in Havana, how long did it take you to write Havana Nocturne?
Probably 3 years. Yeah, they take 3 years to research and write.
Now, you have some, your research skills are fucking magnificent. And, you know, I read the credits for The Corporation. When you went to Cuba and you found out, I'd say you heard the story about Santo when Kennedy came down. When you when you approach these people, how would they react to you at first? I mean, this isn't a Cuban guy going up to a Cuban guy. This is a white guy going up to a Cuban guy.
Yeah. Well, you know, when I first went to Cuba to do research for Havana Nocturne, it was right at the time that Fidel Castro disappeared from public with some strange ailment that the Cuban government wasn't revealing what it was. Everyone knew that Castro was sick and he had disappeared. You remember this?
Yes.
In 2006?
Yes.
Yeah, and so there was rumors that Castro was dead, and
there was a body double, and yeah, there was a bunch of shit.
Yeah. So I had applied with the U.S. government to get authorization to go there legally through the Treasury Department. You get a special visa to go there and do research, and I had gotten it. I had gotten the okay from the U.S. And so I'm heading down to Cuba. And I just happened to be heading there right when all this shit hits the fan about Fidel and his health and whether he's dead or alive. And a lot of people, journalists, friends, and Cubans were telling me, you're not going to get in to Cuba. They're on lockdown right now. They're paranoid about information being leaked. If they know you're a writer or journalist, they're not going to let you in. So I was like, shit, I got to go. I got my license. It's only good for a specific period of time. I don't want to lose it. So I'm going to go. And then people told me to make up stories, to lie, to get into the country. I said, no, I'm just going to tell them what I'm doing. Because the truth is, in Cuba, you know, they're proud of having chased the mafia off the island. So it's a story that they're predisposed to like having written. But I had to convince them that I was sincere and all that. So what I did was, just by chance, this was not intentional. I had packed my bags and I had packed a book, paperback book, The Collected Writings of Jose Marti. And it was right on top of my clothes. It was the first thing you'd see when you opened the bag. So I get to Cuba and right away I stand out. This is back in 06. There's not a lot of travelers going there at that time. And they pull me out of the line and with my bags and take me into a separate room. And I get a pretty rigorous interrogation. What are you doing here? Where are you going? What are your intentions? All in Spanish. So like I'm immediately having to use my Spanish. And the guy is uptight. I can see he's really not sure whether he's going to let me in or not. And then he opens my bags and he sees that copy of The Collected Writings of Jose Marti, and it was like a weight was lifted off his shoulders, man. He just kind of like lightened up. There was something magical about that book, Jose Marti, and they let me in. And so I was in, and once you're sort of allowed into Cuba and you're authorized, people were pretty talkative, as long as I was getting the proper introduction, you know, as is the case anywhere. If you're introduced to somebody by somebody they know and trust, then there's a good chance you might get them to talk to you. So it was easier than you might think once I got there.
You know, I want you to describe to people. In 1985, I met a Panamanian woman in Fort Lee, New Jersey. She lived in the building, you know, whatever. I was hiding out from North Bergen guys looking for me. And we became friends. She was a lot older than me. I mean, no sexual, just friends. I'd see her in the laundry room. And she once told me, she looked me in the face and she goes, I went to Cuba as a young girl. And it was a beautiful, beautiful, beautiful country. And I had a good time. But when I left there, I realized that they were pushing the envelope a bit too far. She goes, you know, she was really Catholic, and she said, I never forgot thinking that God would punish them one day for what they were doing there. She goes, it was a little more dirtier than what I expected at the time. And she goes, 5 years after that, Castro, boom, and look what Cuba is today. They're a starving nation, blah, 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 blah.
Yeah.
And it was very interesting that she said that to mm-hmm. me, that she goes, you know, everybody says that Las Vegas is the new Cuba. She goes, that's an extreme. She goes, it was so blatantly satanic. Did you read that article I think I sent you a couple weeks ago, In Search of Superman?
No. Did you send me that? I don't remember getting that.
Superman
you,
was...
You mean the sex performer Superman?
Yes. The 50,
yeah, no, I didn't.
50 years of research looking for this guy. Even mm-hmm. Duval went God, to I'm going to look for that. It. I'm going to look for it. It's on my Facebook page. Yeah. 50 years of research. And they answered a lot of questions for me. Because I'm like you, TJ. I was born there, but I left when I was three. I remember a beach. I remember a house and driving in a Cadillac and taking pictures. That I don't remember anything else about Cuba. But in that article, they pretty much broke it down. He was fucking a chick. And the funny thing was, in my special, I opened up a joke about his grandson. Cubans are very proud of who their grandparents, and, you know, this kid bragged that the guy in Godfather 2 was his grandfather. So he owned the bar on 38th Street called Club 38, which he bought from Nene Marquez. Nene Marquez owned that bar first in the 60s and 50s. My mother owned a little diner next to it called the OK, up the block from a school called Washington School. But he had bought it, and on Saturdays, you know, during the week they did salsa, but on Saturdays he took his dick out and fucked some Cuban chick live for 200 Cubans while they drank fucking rum and clapped and shit. And, you know, well, this article really went deep, TJ, and it was a 30-minute read, and they found the guy and blah, 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 and they also found out that Marlon Brando was one of his lovers. Just fucking, but they said, listen, man, at that time, people went to Cuba to see that guy with the big dick. Like, that was the biggest fucking attraction they had, was watching a guy with a 16-inch dick fuck some poor, helpless fucking human trafficking chick from China or something, because they did it at a Chinese restaurant. Did you?
Well, no, they did it at a place called the Shanghai Theater.
The Shanghai Theater, whatever the fuck it was. Now, when you were down there, did you? You know, it was Chinese fucking people. You know, Shanghai Theater, and they had to serve egg rolls, TJ. Knock it off. They had to serve something. Somebody's getting dick. They got to serve some type of food.
15-inch egg rolls.
Yeah, 15-inch egg rolls. But it was. Did you get that same impression? Like, there was a reason why those Cubans wanted to overtake the casinos, and they were lied to, they were sold a bill of lading. Did you get that feeling?
Well, first of all, let me go back to Superman, because I did a fair amount of research on that. In fact, I was able to, there was a guy in Tampa who was the son of a lawyer who represented Santo Tomas.
And he got the tapes. He had the tapes.
He had a video of Superman fucking a girl, and in a private like club in somebody's home, they had these sex salons where you'd go to the nice part of town and you'd go to a nice house and there would be live sex shows there, cocktail party and live sex shows.
Egg rolls.
But he, egg rolls. So this guy would had the tape, but he would not let it out of his possession. He said, "If you come here to Tampa, I will show it to you." Never forget, I got to his office. He also is a lawyer, went to his legal office. He said, come at 6 when it closes and there's nobody around so we can watch it. And I get there and he sets it up in a conference room and he got this Super 8 footage of Superman fucking this poor woman, and he's hitting her from every conceivable angle, and it did not look pleasurable, man. I mean, he was big and she was not big. And The old man had scored it to music like Wagner and shit, like triumphant classical music, to the scene of Superman fucking this woman. So that was pretty amazing. I don't know if there's any other actual footage that exists of that guy. So I was able to see him. I was told that he died of gangrene.
Yeah, no, and the article says he died in Mexico of a jealous lover. The kid who, you know, some woman he fucked, he went on the run. He was a gardener in the daytime, and he got paid $25 a night for his shows. And then the writer went deep, and he goes, look, we're not here to, you know, tell you about his life as a performer. We're here to tell you about how tragic his life really was.
Yeah, no, I know it ended quite tragically.
That he got $125. And these people would pay fucking $50 American to see him fuck somebody, you know.
It was a freak show, is what it was, you know. And it was particularly popular with politicians. I mean, that scene in The Godfather, with Godfather 2, where they show him taking the senator to the club to see Superman. That's very accurate, because that's they used to use that show, that sex show, to like show it off to the politicians and businessmen who were coming into town. Everyone wanted to see it. And they'd take them over there and give them a thrill, let them see it.
When you were down in Cuba, did you meet any Cubans with Irish last names?
Yeah, yeah. Did in fact, you know? the main street in little old Havana, Havana Vieja, is O'Reilly Street.
You believe that? Because of the Battle of the Boyne, all the Cubans, all the Irish went to Cuba because it was the only other Catholic country. And they didn't want to, you know, they just wanted to keep the party alive, the Irish. They don't want to fight nobody. They just want to keep some fucking beers and some fucking bags.
Yeah, and you know, I love Latin jazz. Afro-Cuban jazz is one of the things I love the most. And one of the founding fathers of Latin jazz is a guy named Chico O'Farrell. Chico O'Farrell was one of the early composers, Irish blood, an Irish Cuban.
So you really fell in love with the culture and all this. So now you go down there. You investigate how they get out of the fucking mob, how they got the mob out of Cuba and took their money. I mean, that fact that you put in your book that Batista was getting $1.5 million a week, that's $6 million American every fucking month. That's $72 million a year. If he was making 72, can you imagine what the mob was really making?
Yeah, but you know, they knew they had to pay him well. And he put a high tariff on them to allow them to do their thing. But, of course, he totally allowed them to do their thing. He stayed out of their way, and they had those casinos up and running, and there was no gaming commission. You know, the mob was the gaming commission. So they were pretty much free to the casino money went right into their pocket, or it went to the cut of it that went to Batista. The deal, of course, is that he would keep the lid on everything and that there would be no revolution. And that was Batista's job. That's what he was getting paid for. And he kept telling them things were fine, that this little thing with Castro and disputes around the country was being squelched, that there was no chance at all that this would be successful and that it would take over the country. And of course, it was a dictatorship, and he controlled the media. He controlled everything that was reported in the newspapers and on TV. And everything that was reported was that the army has the matter in hand. The revolution is going nowhere. We're defeating the rebels at every turn, blah, 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 blah. So nobody saw it coming. Nobody saw it coming. I mean, it wasn't until January 1st, 1959, when the Revolutionary Guard came rolling into Havana that everybody fled suddenly. You know, Batista got out of there in the dead of night on an airplane and suitcases full of cash. And Lansky got out of there a few days later, and Trafficante didn't get out of there. He got snatched and held in prison and thought he was going to be executed. He was on an execution list, and the rumor is, I think it's more than a rumor, it's a fact that he paid $1 million in cash directly to Raul Castro to get out of prison so that he could leave the island.
Now, I read somewhere when Batista left, he left with $250 million.
Hard to calculate, but yeah. I mean, whatever he could carry, he took with him, I'm sure.
So now, you write Havana Nocturne and you want to know about the mob. So this is how the whole Jose battle thing comes into play.
Yeah, well, this is one of the great mobster stories, I think, of recent times. And it was just sitting there waiting to be written. Really, I had heard of Battle. I knew the Battle story. Battle was a numbers racketeer whose name would pop up in the local papers in New York as far back as the 1980s. And there was always talk about the Cubans and the so-called corporation and what that was. And I always was interested in it because I thought it had some connection to the anti-Castro political movement also, the attempts to overthrow Cuba, to destabilize the Cuban government, to assassinate Castro, to take back Cuba. This was always a part of it, although I wasn't sure how these pieces fit together, I could kind of see that they were all one and the same thing. Battle was a very kind of charismatic guy, very earthy looking guy, salt of the earth character, a certain amount of charisma, street level charisma, not an intellectual by any stretch, more of a street guy. But he had this incredible reputation because he had been a soldier during the Bad Pigs invasion. He got captured and held in prison in Cuba. So I was sort of aware of all of this, even back when I was writing Havana Nocturne. And in fact, Battle died, I believe, in 2006, right when I was into the research of Havana Nocturne. And I had a guy who helped me with my Spanish, a Cuban guy, would come over here and sit in my apartment, and I would read to him. And he was so good. Now, anywhere I travel in the world, Mexico or whatever, and I speak Spanish, they think I'm Cuban because I speak Spanish with a Cuban accent. But he used to tell me about the corporation, and he said the corporation is the most powerful organized crime entity in the Latin world. He said they're untouchable. They have this mystique that they have some connections to the CIA because of the Bay of Pigs invasion, and they're all powerful, and nobody can fuck with them, and everyone fears them. And so I was kind of aware of it, but you know, it doesn't get a lot of press in the mainstream media. Back then, everything was mafia, mafia, mafia. It was the only thing it seemed that anyone wanted to hear about. And I knew there were all these great crime stories because I was writing a lot of it as a journalist. I did a series for Playboy magazine called The New Mob, and it was like an article on a Jamaican posse from Kingston that had set up operations in Brooklyn. I did an article about the Chinese triads and went to Hong Kong. So I was aware that there was much more than just the Italian mafia out there. And I was interested in the Cuban thing, but I just didn't see how I could write the story. I didn't have the sources. I didn't have a way in to the story. So I was kind of lusting from afar at the story of Jose Miguel Battle. And I knew it was a great book. I thought, well, someone else is going to write that book, probably, and I'll feel bad about it and wish that I had done it. But I really didn't have the sources to do it. And that didn't happen until fairly recently, about 3 years ago. I get contacted by these two young Cuban-American movie producers, and they contact my agent and they say, we've been developing this material, a story on Jose Miguel Battle and the corporation, and we think it would be a great book. They said, does TJ English know anything about this story, and would he be interested in doing it? And I said, yeah, fuck yeah. I know the story very, very well, at least as well as know it from just what's in the mainstream media. And I said, so what do you guys have? You know, right away, I wanted to know what they had. And what they had was this cop who had worked the corporation case pretty much almost his whole career, close to 20 years. And he'd become obsessed with Battle. And he'd been involved in all these investigations over the years with all the different agencies, FBI, everyone else who got involved at different points along the way. This guy knew more about Battle and the corporation than any single person. And not only that, he kept all the documents, man. He had like a mother load of police reports and autopsy reports and transcripts of criminal hearings and trials. And he had a mother load of information. And once I saw what he had, I said, yeah, I think I can do this. And then I still had a lot of work to do because, if this is the third book of mine you've read now, you know they're pretty intensely researched, and I try to go deep, and I try to get at intimate, interpersonal stuff. You know, not just the stuff you would get from reading a newspaper article or magazine article. So I knew I had to try to meet people who had lived this story, or maybe were just one step removed, who could place me there, so that I can write it in such a way that the reader feels like they're right there in the thick of it.
When I first found out about this, I remember my heart beating the way it is now from listening to you. I've known for 15 years that there's a tremendous story there. There was always a tremendous story. When I was nine, on the weekends, when I came home from Catholic school, I would have to deliver flowers for La Casa La Flore. And that was owned by a guy named Jose Toymil, who was a big-time bookmaker, who we'll get to later. He was one of Battle's guys, and I remember them specifically saying that these flowers better be fucking perfect. So Battle or his mother or his son, you know, it could have been anybody, but they lived in a tall high-rise building at the time. So if I was nine, this had to be 72, 71. You and I spoke a little bit. You came to one of the shows. It was packed. I didn't really get to see you much. We spoke a few times after that. I go to my daughter's dance recital. And I come home that night, and there's a package on the fucking thing, and it's half ripped open because everything my wife lives on Amazon. So every time I come home, there's a fucking box in front of the goddamn house. So I bring the book in, TJ, and I sit down. My daughter comes in. We're talking, and I didn't really have a chance to read, but I opened up to a page, and it was fucking goosebumps. It was the page where Ernestico, Nina, and Monchi's wife come to visit him, and they do blow, and they rob the jewelry store, and next thing you know, there's compromising pictures and stuff like that, and yeah. I close the fucking book. You know, I told a joke for years, which is a true story. We lived on 89th Street on Riverside Drive. This had to be 68, 69. On Tuesday nights, my mom would sit around with six women, and they'd play dominoes and cards and do blow and fucking drink and listen to Jim Morrison and talk about how hot Jim Morrison was. And one of those women was Nina. You know, I was very tight with her. And I remember growing up and her husband Tati coming in and out of jail, but he was always very close to me because of my father. I didn't understand it at the time. When he would come to me, he would say, you know, pick up your chest. You know, you eat pussy yet? I must have been six. And he would ask me, do you eat pussy yet? You know, you got to eat pussy. Your father loved eating fucking pussy. He had a tattoo of a fucking scorpion on his dick. Your father was a real man. And this was every, but he would disappear for periods of time. And then he'd come back. He'd give me, you know, I could be nine and he'd give me $300. Don't tell your mother, you know. When my mother died and I had to live with the Italian family, the Benders who took me in, my dog went to Nina. I knew those people. Like, I closed the book right away, and I think I called you.
Yeah.
And I said, I knew this. And the thing about, you know, you spoke about in Havana Nocturne how the revolution started in Union City, Tampa, and then Cuba, obviously.
Yeah.
But you spoke about the three brothers that Battle approached that were down on their luck, and he made partners with the one Irish brother. First thing I did when I read that was called Mike Askalis. His mother, Patricia, lived on 19th Street in Union City, grew up there as a child. And she still remembers Fidel Castro talking to her. She goes, wow. I knew fucking Fidel when he would still just talk to, he was talking to her. And, you know, so I called and told him the name. Sure enough, he calls back 3 days later. And Michael talked to you for hours because he knows the whole history of Union City. Mm-hmm. Like, early, but I was so impressed with what you had done. Like somebody had finally opened the door on this story.
Yeah.
Because I grew up in this. You know, I was that kid, TJ, that would come to your house and we'd be watching something. And your mother would say, you know, I went and did something today. And I couldn't tell you what my mother was doing that day. I had two worlds growing up. I lived in a kid's world, and I lived around guys like Tati and Monchi and Malagamba and Nene Carrero. And there was a whole lot, you know, that bar was a bookmaking bar at night. That's where they celebrated, was at my mother's bar. So I remember half the stories. Like, I remember the car bombing in 76.
Yeah.
And my mother used to tell me, you know, when I got out of Catholic school in the fifth grade, I used to go to McKinley School right off of Route 3. If you go by Route 3 and you stay on there, you pass the York Motel where the Iceman chopped the body in half.
Yeah. Yeah.
Right across from there, there's a fucking an embroidery shop and a school. That's McKinley. I used to go to McKinley, and when I would walk down the stairs, Dottie would be there with a fucking Cadillac. And he'd pick me up, take me into the city, take me to get a haircut. I don't know what he'd do up the corner on that diner. He'd go in there while I was getting my hair cut. The stage or something was there. And then we...
What did he do? Did you... What did you know of what he did for a living?
At that time, what I knew was that he did something. I don't know what he did. I thought it was something with cocaine.
Something illegal.
Yes, I knew it was cocaine related. Yeah. Okay, and then...
Yeah.
Then he went away one time, and Nina shows up with this black Cuban. Black Cuban with gold fucking teeth and gold everywhere. His name was El Negro Marcelo. And that was her new husband. And to me, my loyalty was with fucking Tati. Even at that age, as a young kid, I asked my mom, what the fuck is this shit? But I knew that she went both ways. There was times I went to a house and there'd be a young girl there. Nina was just a fucking sexual deviant animal. I mean, that's the only way. As I got older, even when I was 16, after my mother died, there was nights I would walk home and she was living on 51st in North Bergen, and I'd jump the fence, and I'd play with the dog, and she'd be in there with three fucking chicks, coked up to the gills. She was heavier then, and she would talk to me for a little while, but she became kind of a cunt later on towards me after my mother died.
Well, we should tell people, Tati, Monchi, and Malagamba were three very notorious professional hitmen. For organized crime, for Cuban organized crime. And some of it was just gangster shit, you know, hits that were done for business reasons. But they also were professional political assassins. They were used to do killings on behalf of an organization called Omega 7, which was, you know, an anti-Castro militant, a terrorist organization, basically, a group that was dedicated to doing covert bombings, assassinations, all in the interest of trying to destabilize Cuba and bring down Castro. So we're talking about, you know, some heavy motherfuckers.
I knew you couldn't utter the words Fidel as freely as you could today in Union City. When I was growing up, I told a joke a couple of weeks ago that I got cousins of the commies. I don't even know what a fucking commie is, TJ English. I just knew that you didn't talk to them. You know, I was raised that
Joey, this is interesting because I don't think the average American, and even some Cubans maybe that didn't grow up, you know, either in Union City or Miami, they don't know this history. They don't know how heavy that was.
Heavy, heavy. Heavy. You couldn't even say Fidel in the late 60s and 70s. Yeah. It wasn't until Marielle opened that it really loosened up, but that's when shit hit the fucking fan.
Yeah, well, a lot of those guys, the Marielitos, they got used for, you know, doing a lot of the wet work, so to speak, you know, the dirty work for the mob. I mean, they became guys you'd have go do murders that you knew they weren't going to survive that murder, you know, and they were so desperate, they'd do it for $10.
You know, there's a lot of names in the book that I remember, and there's a lot of names in the book I don't remember, and I wish I would have got to your ear a year earlier.
Yeah, that would have.
Because there was, you know, like I remember there was a guy, Miguel, that had his own bank. He ended up moving to Florida. He walked with a pigeon toe. So they would always goof on my mother that he was really my father. And he was married to a Puerto Rican woman named Marlene. And I guess Nene Carrero, who owned a barbershop, had a problem with him one day.
Yeah.
He fucked his wife and he shot Nene in the leg. You know, this was common knowledge that I would hear whispers of at the bar. And I grew up in a house that was Mira, Oye, y Calla. For American people listening, in my house, my mom had elephants everywhere, and she had monkeys everywhere. But the monkeys all had the same meaning. They all covered their eyes, their ears, and their mouths.
Yeah.
So I was not allowed to repeat this. You mentioned two stories in the book, one about a Cuban doctor. I know exactly who they're talking about. That was my family doctor as a child.
Right. And you mentioned the name, and I had the name. The lawyer wouldn't let me use the name.
Oh, my God. Name.
What was it, Del Valle?
Del Valle. He would come over to my house. When his office was in Weehawken. But when I lived on 205 West 88th Street, he would come over in the afternoons. I always had a bad problem with my tonsils, TJ. He would come over, come into the back room, touch my temperature. Jose Antonio, you have a fever. I have to give you a penicillin shot. And I would go, let me think about it. He loved it. Because
that must be from all that pussy you were eating when you were 6 years
old. No, listen to this. This motherfucker would go out in the living room and start doing bumps with my mom and whoever else was there. And then he'd come in an hour later, fucked up to the gills, and give me a needle. And then he'd leave my mother two syringes and a bottle of penicillin. Well, Del Valle was well known as the man for whatever you needed. If you got shot at 4 a.m, Del Valle took care of you. You know, if you needed anything.
That's just what you want, a coked up guy with a needle in his hand standing over you.
Fucking
right?
But I got to tell you something. Between you and I, TJ, till this day, 2017, I still talk to him once a year, and I love him dearly. Mm. I love him dearly. I bumped into him at a disco years later, and he came up to me, and he goes, tell me that you have a blast. Tell me that you have something for the head. And I looked at him, I got nothing but up. And this is what he said. Dime que tiene algo para la cabeza. And I go, tengo aspirina. And he goes, no me diga eso con suerte. And he walked away from me. That's the last time I physically told him. And you also told a story in the book about Jose Battle getting arrested in North Bergen. Okay, he got arrested in North Bergen for something minor. You ready for this one? I called one of my friends that are cops, and I asked him, and I told him about the book. He pre-ordered it. He called me back 4 days later. He goes, dog, I looked into that arrest where he got arrested in North Bergen. They didn't even put the handcuffs on him.
Oh, yeah, that one.
When they drove him to the station, and by the time he got to the station, supposedly, the call was already in.
Yeah.
See,
he controlled.
That was their...
He controlled that town.
That was their genius that nobody understood. Yeah. This is why I do not watch CNN. I do not care about political elections, because I was exposed to something between the ages of 8 and 12 that broke my system down at an early age. I saw cops getting paid off, you know, at an early age. I saw, you know, cops that would have uniforms on in the daytime at family Santeria parties, snorting coke. And I also... When I went to North Bergen, that's a completely different political system that's tied into Union City and Weehawken also.
Yeah.
So I got to see the political system in a micro way.
Yeah.
I couldn't even imagine the macro corruption if the micro was as bad as I had seen.
Yeah. Yeah, no, it's fascinating. And a lot of it was gambling money. Gambling money was allowed to flourish. Gambling is allowed to flourish there. Numbers in Bergen County, Hudson County, that numbers racket predates Cubans. You know, Battle was brilliant. And Battle came and plugged into a pre-existing system, knowing that he was going to bring with him all of these Latinos that were playing the numbers like a religion. But he was very careful about getting approval from all the people he needed to get approval from. He went to the mafia guys, told them what he was going to do, cut them in on a piece of it. He went to these Irish brothers that had the connection between gambling and the police. And he took over from them with their blessing by giving them a piece of it. The whole system of corruption that had existed there for, I don't know, a century probably. He went there and, you know, because he was from Havana in the 50s, and I didn't even mention that, you know, he was a vice cop in Havana in the 50s and supposedly was the bag man for the mob who would deliver the money from Traficante to Batista to the presidential palace. Battle knew how the world went round, man. He knew how things worked. He was coming as having been a cop, having been a corrupt cop in one of the most corrupt places ever. And he just said, you know, you take care of everybody. You make everyone who's supposed to get a piece gets a piece. And everybody's happy. And if you keep everybody happy, then we all get rich together. And it worked for a long time. I mean, that the corporation was up and running before it was ever even called the corporation for a long time, for decades. And then it continued even longer than that. The thing that Battle tripped up on is he had another Cuban trait. And that was, this guy had a very overdeveloped need for revenge. If he ever got wronged in any way, or he felt his honor had been insulted in some way, this fucker would spend years calculating ways to take you out and get revenge.
Why is that in our system, TJ? Can you tell me why Man on Fire is my favorite movie? Can you tell me why Death Wish is my favorite movie? Can you explain to me why
I have an ex-wife in Colorado?
I'll tell you why.
With the Cubans, lots of it comes from Spain, comes from the Spanish. The Spanish have a very sophisticated and elaborate thing of honor, and if your honor is stepped on in any way, that you are honor bound in return to get revenge, to exact revenge, and you really are not even a decent man anymore if you don't do that, and it's all tied into manhood. Getting revenge for having been wronged. And so fucking Latinos have it, and everyone has it. I mean, Irish have it, Italians have it. But
not that it keeps Spanish, you up at night. My ex-wife in Boulder, Colorado, 20 years. I'm happily married. I'm doing what I'm doing, and I still can't trust myself to go to Boulder, TJ English. I go to Denver and I stay in the hotel and I pray to God that I don't have to go to Boulder. And I tell you this from one man to another, that I don't trust myself. If somebody cuts me off, I won't go over there. I'm still telling you as a man right now, and I could care if the cops are listening or the DA or fucking Law and Order, that I still dream about fucking slicing her fucking throat, TJ English. I don't know why. It's got to be something in your genes. It's got to be. One thing about the Cuban household is the main word is nunca te quedes dao. No venga pa esta casa dao. And that goes with the Irish. The Irish have that too. Mm-hmm. And that means don't come home to this house hit. Don't you dare walk into this house hit. You fight till the end. If he's bigger than you, you hit him in the head with a chair. You break his fucking head. And every time he combs his hair, he'll think of you hitting him in the chair. That's the Cuban mentality. I cannot lie to you that was my mother's fucking number one pet peeve. No venga esta casa dao. Do not stay hit. By no means, never in your life.
And there's no dishonor in being beat in a fight as long as you fight.
As long as you fight it out.
Not fighting.
Listen, man, first of all, I want to thank you for your time. I want to thank you for your gift. But one thing I also want you to explain to these fucking lunatics that don't know is how deep the number system goes in our soul. You explained it in the book. You even broke it down to La Charrada, the Book of Dreams. You know, if you go to 118th Street in those days, when I was a kid, you would walk into a candy store that had one Yoo-Hoo in the shelf and three boxes of fucking candy that hadn't been touched in 20 years. It had dust on it. And there was a bulletproof glass, or sometimes it was an open counter, and there were 10 magazines hanging all about dreams. So if you have a dream about getting hit by an ambulance, it's 32 and you put a 5 prefix. How deep is that in the Cuban?
Yeah, no, it's fucking amazing. It's like a deep, it's like a religion. It is a religion. It's an extension of numerology, you know. It's a belief that, that through numbers you can know the mysteries of life, and that everything that happens and everything that is associated with a number. And, you know, if you can somehow align those numbers, put the numbers together, you can be rich. And Bolita was a system that made that possible. You could be rich if you hit the number, you bet the number. And so it was like, well, there has to be a science to this. What's the science? And the science was like deciphering your dreams. So like you just said, every animal or many different things have a number assigned to it. And so if those things pop up in your dreams, then you use those numbers to bet the number. And people believed it, like you would believe a religion. You believe in it really, really strongly. And all it took was for like one person to hit it, and it was like, see, shit, coño, you know, bet that number, man. I had the dream. I told you there was a dog in my dream, you know, whatever that number is. And so that extended itself to the idea that the Boliteros, the people who organized Bolita, who were the overseers of Bolita, Jose Miguel Battle, and all the people in his organization, were somehow the dream makers. These were the guys that you could make your dreams come true. And so they had a certain mystique within the community. They were more than just gangsters, really. They were cultural figures that were tied into this thing of Bolita as this kind of almost like a pagan religion that had deep, deep meaning to everybody. So it wasn't just a criminal activity. It was a cultural activity. Betting the number, being interested in the number was, you know, it was a communal thing for Cubans. It was part of the culture. And it wasn't meant to be violent, by the way. Back in Cuba, Bolita was not a violent. It was illegal, but everyone sort of allowed it to happen. Cops bet the number. Little old ladies bet the number. The corner priest bets the number. It was considered to be a victimless crime. It's not supposed to be violent. It got violent because it got so profitable. What Battle created became so profitable that greed set in, and greed led to the violence. But Bolita itself is a...
It's a beautiful thing. It really is when you think about it. It's I grew up in it. You know, I grew up in it early on. One day I went to Union City and joined the basketball league. And I walked in with a T-shirt and it said 57 on it. And my stepfather Juan was on the phone while I walked in. And he goes, "What's that number on that shirt?" And 57. And all of a sudden, we got in the car, and he ran up, because he would not use the phone. He ran up to the corner, and he put $10 on 557. 6 o'clock, he told me I hit the number. I won $5,000. I think he gave me $2,000. He kept the rest. You know, it's such a... my birthday, 1969, on 219, 219 came out. And I went to Jersey City. It snowed a foot and a half of fucking snow, TJ English. Me and my little Goombas decided to take the number one bus to go see some fucking Pink Panther movie or some shit. We walk in the house and my mother tells you, "Son of a bitch, you hit the fucking number for $5,000. I gave her a couple grand and I opened up a bank account at fucking HUD, the Hudson United Savings there in Union City. And I hit the number a couple times. I used to be pretty good with it. It was, my mother had a guy that sat there all day, 10 o'clock to 3, just taking numbers on a little tiny sheet of fucking paper. Tiny. And he would write the number and he would fold it up very tightly and put it in his hat. Because in Jersey, as you know, it's a felony, but in New York City in those days, it was a misdemeanor. And I just want to tell you one last point about Union City. Let me tell you how corrupt Union City was in those days. Never mind the fucking Cubans, the numbers, the politicians, what was going on in Hoboken. Do you know what was around the corner from the Nen Marquez's old club, Club 38? A bar by the name of Bottom of the Barrel. Now, I know in your crime research and all your reading, you've read of bottom of the barrel. I'll tell you two figures who hung out at bottom of the barrel. Tons. Number one, Henry Hill. And I confirmed that when I did a movie a few years ago, and he was on the set. And number two, the guy that turned on Castellano, Dominic Montiglio.
Yeah.
He hung out there a lot. Union City was a very hot bed. I mean, you know, originally the Iceman is from Jersey City, but he lived in West New York. And then he lived in North Bergen on 74th Street across from the Coke Factory. I snorted so much Coke at that Coke Factory. We all did. In the backyard. That if they take a dog there today, 20 years later, that dog will fucking die. He cut his wife's nipples off in that building, in that house, in his book. So that area is a very interesting place. I thank you for shining a light on it. Because you opened the door to a thousand things that are going to come now.
Yeah.
Because people like me know the stories. I mean, I grew up in this small community that was, I remember that bar on 48th Street where in Estico, I don't know the name of it, but they had a tremendous bistec de palomilla with white rice and they'd sprinkle that, what's that green shit, parsley? They sprinkle that on the Cuban steak with fried tortones and black beans.
Nice.
It was fucking tremendous. But TJ, I love your writing. I am so happy you opened up this.
It's a pleasure, Joey. It's one of the great pleasures with this book is lifting the lid on this history. And I do think it's given people the opportunity to talk about certain things. I mean, I had a lot of younger people who were sort of the sons and daughters of, or the nieces and nephews of a lot of the main players in this story. And a lot of them reached out to me. And I really had a feeling that there was a generation of people, Cubans, who'd grown up in the shadow of all of this and haven't been able to talk about it for generations. It's kept it bottled up. And it's never good to keep stuff bottled up. So, you know, I hope it's a process of people getting some of this history off their chest.
TJ, I never thought people would believe me.
Yeah.
I never really thought people would believe me about the Frank Mona stories and the two cops that would come in for the beat cop and the regular cop that would come in for an envelope. I still remember them, you know, Newark, some guy named Paniagua, a Cuban fucking ruthless guy that's ran Newark drugs, and he made a call to my mother's bar. So the payphone at my mother's bar was connected to a house phone behind the bar so she could answer it. They got her on conspiracy charges, and I still remember me being in my living room and the phone ringing. And it was a dear cop that I knew that said to me, hey, man, tell your mother to clean the house that she's about to get a visitor. And then they said, come over when you're finished. And I went upstairs and I told my mom. And I, sure enough, I went down. She threw away a bunch of shit. And next thing you know, as I was walking down the block with my basketball, I saw the detectives making a left turn onto my block. It was that type of community that it was so corrupt. But then again, it seemed like it was normal.
Yeah, it was the norm.
It was the fucking norm, you know.
Yeah.
You and I could go for hours about things you discovered while you were writing this book that people wouldn't believe. Now, I know that you have TJEnglish.com. You're selling the book on there, and you also have the book pre-ordering on Amazon.com.
Yeah, Amazon. And there's one other thing I want to mention. I'm hosting a Latin jazz series at the Zinc Lounge in the Village in New York every Thursday night in April to promote the book, but also just because I love the music. And it's like a dream come true for me. I get to choose the musicians. I get to host the evening. So anybody out there who likes Latin jazz, we're gonna have some of the best of it at that series.
Now, I will see you Tuesday night for the book premiere. I'm excited.
And we will talk for hours about the stuff that's in the books. It won't be on the air, all of it.
No, well, then you're doing Rogan on the 26th, and Rogan opened up a little more. That's why I didn't want to do a lot of spoilers. I just wanted to tell you that, you know, you always want to do what you can't do. And I know I can do it. But you writing this book really opened my eyes to writing. I've been writing every day since then. I want to thank you. I want to thank you for your gift, your talent, and for writing this beautiful story. And I want people to pre-order your book on Amazon so you get the word out. And it's going to be turned into a movie and hopefully a Latin series or whatever the fuck. It doesn't even matter. Just that you got the story out there. You're like the Ronda Rousey of the Cuban fucking community now. You exposed us. You opened the fucking door. So, TJ, I love you to all my heart, man. And this is no bullshit.
I love you, Joey. Thanks.
I love you what you did. And I will see you Tuesday, tip-top Magoo, ready to fucking go.
Yes, you will. All right?
Thank you for calling in, my brother. Ciao.
Yeah.
That was great, man.
It was
fucking crazy.
So, like, it's very inspiring to see how much work. He said it took 3 years of research and writing, and there's a lot more to putting a book together like this than you would think.
Well, let me tell you something. There's a lot of fucking research. When you read a book, like I read the copy that's, what does it say on here? It's whatever proof, not for sale. I read the uncorrected proof, not for sale. And then he sent me a copy of the finished product. And I'm just saving that for myself. And it's funny how I could tell he did a lot of research. And if you see the credits, I mean, one thing that you guys should know is my name is in one of the credits because I contacted him and whatnot. But just all the people he interviewed, there is acknowledgments that are, you know, maybe from page 524 to 560, there's acknowledgments of people that he spoke to and different conversations and shit like that, which means he did the work, he did the research. I mean, for me to write a book like this, it'd take me fucking 10 years. I'm trying to write a book about me, and it's taken me fucking 4 years already, you know, just outlining and shit like that and what seems important and what seems not. And I can't imagine. You have to dedicate yourself to this shit.
Well, he mentioned briefly on the phone call how he wants to go deeper than just news articles or something. And it's a very, because you guys mentioned that it was a story that needed to be told.
Yes.
But it's also, the timing has to work perfectly because he can't just go to newspapers. It's not like they wrote the stuff down. He had the police reports and stuff like that, but that only gives you a certain view of it. You have to go and it's not research like writing a paper. He has
that's why I asked
to learn
him
the full story.
That's why I asked him how hard it was to get the people, get people to talk to you, get people to lighten up. Let me give some shout outs real quick here. First off to my man, his birthday over there in Japan, Sad Hatek. Your girlfriend hit me up and told me to say happy birthday, Sad. So there you go. You're over there in Japan listening, you bad motherfucker. Sad Hatek, my man Nick Owens, Dwayne Johnson, Patrice Sodette, Random Rocha, Brad Morrissey, Jeff Boone, Jay Bichetti, Andrew Nandal, who I'll see Wednesday night, my man Rene Encarnacion, who I'll see Wednesday night in NIAC, and 1971 Capital. Don't forget, April 5th and 6th, I'm at the Santa Ana Casino. I think the 6th is already sold out, and all you got left is Thursday night at 7:30, which is still, I'm still going to rock that fucking show. I'm fresh like a motherfucking ready to go. And then 4:20, Columbus, Ohio, that whole fucking weekend, Thursday, Friday, and Saturday. And then if you know anything about me, the mules, I got mules leaving here April, like, 14th, bringing a pound of weed and tons of edibles to fucking Columbus. So if I was you, you better check your insurance policy and make sure you're allowed to go to the hospital. And they don't charge you a lot for emergency motherfucking visits. No. I've always been a groupie, not a groupie, but a fan of authors. Like, I've always, I really liked when I read the Godfather books as a child, Mario Puzo. I just like a certain style of writing. There's people that overwrite, and they knock me the fuck down because they try to be witty, and they forget what the fuck they're doing. That shit fucking drives me crazy. But when I read something that's well-written and something like I said, I have stock in this story. I grew up in this. I saw this around me, and I was not allowed to talk about it. Did I know Tati and Malagamba were fucking Omega 7? Not at all.
And like that,
I never even heard the word Omega 7, you know, till years later.
I believe that. It's not that I think you're lying, but some of the stories you tell are just so out there that you're like, maybe he's just misremembering it, or I don't know. But no. Then like we get your friends, or like this guy who you have no idea, and he's like, oh yeah, those guys were political assassins.
I'm it was
like,
crazy.
Jesus.
And he was at my house for every Christmas shit like that. You know, I forgot to tell the story that he, you know, Nina, his wife, was dating this Negro Marcello when he would go to jail. And Tati would go to jail every two fucking years. Like, he'd be out for a year and then he'd go to jail for 2 years. And one time he actually came out and shot that motherfucker. They were like, he's gone. Everybody knew it was Tati. Nope, the cops didn't say nothing. Nobody said nothing. You know, my mother warned me of hanging out with two people, and one of them was Tati, that one day he's going to get shot, and I don't want you in a car with him. And Malagamba, Danny Bianculo, who used to call into the podcast a lot, I was tight with Malagamba growing up. I was really not as tight as I was with Tati, but I always talked to Malagamba, and he was always nice to me and shit. And after my mother died, he sent for me one day. He called Danny and asked Danny where, and I went up there and told him, and he gave me some money, and I told him that I wanted him to get the money from my stepfather for me. And he was like, that would create a war right now between us. I can't do that. If you need help, just check with me from time to time. You know, I didn't want to be a fucking, even though I was a fucking mooch. And then I just lost contact with those people. And then I heard years later, Tati went to prison because where I used to work at the Galaxy Towers, 1984.
Right.
He went in there. His main thing was tumbes. That's what they call him in Spanish. You know what a tumbe is?
No.
A tumbe is when I tell you, Lee, what's the story? You got those 2 kilos of coke? And you're like, yeah, yeah, meet me at the office. And I show up here and I pull a gun. And I go, there ain't no fucking money. I'm taking this from you. You can't report that to the cops. So that was his main thing.
So ripping off drug dealers.
Ripping off drug dealers was his main thing. What was my main thing?
Ripping off drug dealers.
So it affected me in a way. I got in trouble for doing what he did all the time, which was just rob drug dealers.
Jesus.
So, you see, somewhere along the line, I always felt guilty about this. I never told these stories to nobody. Right. Tati ended up going to jail because he kicked down a door to rob some Colombians, and there were 2 kids there. Well, and he shot the 2 kids, and he killed the Colombians. That's how evil of a person he had become towards the end, you know. But I hadn't seen him. He died in, like, 96 or 97 from cancer. And Nina did, too. Nina died of cancer in Miami. I found that years later.
TJ asked if you knew what he did, and you said at 6. Like, I thought you were going to be like, oh, no, he was just a family friend. Like, I was trying to think back when I was 6. He was a family friend. But no, but you said you knew he did something illegal.
I knew he did something.
That, like, I don't think I knew illegal things existed at 6. I'm trying to think back. I don't remember 6 as clearly as you do. But I don't even think I would have known. I don't know.
I knew they did something. I just didn't know what it was. I didn't ask. I didn't care. They would always throw money in my pockets. Whenever they'd see me, my mother would lose her mind. They would always give me a $100 bill and go buy yourself a toy. I haven't seen you in a few months or something. So I didn't judge them in that way. As I got older, I had heard through different people what Tati did. I knew that he had killed Negro Marcello. So that made him a fucking killer. And this story, he's going to open up 200 other stories. And it's a story I have, the story of how I saw how the machine worked early on. I don't believe nothing. That Bronx Tale that has a line that says, nobody cares.
Okay.
That line sticks out in my mind every day. Because I know at the end of the day, nobody cares. There's few people who really fucking care, you know. And the point I'm trying to make is that as a child, I was exposed to this police corruption. Then I went to North Bergen, and I got exposed to a complete different type of corruption that was right in front of my eyes that was being done by somebody I was very in love and admired with. I admired this family, and I admired the way they raised their kids, and this is what I yearned for as a child, was that type of family environment. So I overlooked the things he did. Until this day, I love him dearly. When he died, he left me money. I left it to my daughter. I put it in my daughter's account for her to have a little start because he loved my daughter. I always sent him pictures and stuff like that. I didn't judge him for those things. I wasn't raised to judge him for those things. I judged him for his heart and how he treated me growing up. Even though I knew he murdered somebody, even though I knew he lit buildings on fire, and he was part of a machine at the time. He was part of a corruption machine at the time that I benefited from. So I'd be a hypocrite if I told you anything his kids got, I got. If they got a motorcycle, I got a motorcycle. If they went to the Hamptons or Montauk, I went to the Hamptons. If they got sneakers, I got sneakers. If they got Yankee tickets, I got Yankee tickets. They were all things from corruption. You know, that park where I played, that 38th Street Park, one of my friends, his team is in the finals, Final Four this weekend of Division III, Chuck McBreen. And me and Chuck McBreen, he's a coach. They just did a write-up about him on Facebook and a bunch of other things that he's a coach. Me and him played basketball since we were kids. I used to go to his backyard. He had a dirt backyard. So whenever you played basketball back there, you'd go home dirty as fuck, Jack. And we were talking about the corruption that we grew up around, but especially like if a net, you know the nets on the basketball rims?
Okay.
Okay. Yeah. If you went to 51st Street and played at 51st Street Park when I was growing up, they had no nets. If you went to 46th Street, if a net broke, it took them a week to fix it. Like for somebody to come down from the town and rehook it up on the thing. Our park, that basketball court, was such a fucking immaculate court. The only problem it had was that it went uphill. But the backboards were brand new and our rims. All I had to do was cross the street, I mean 30 yards, and tell Marianne or Carmine that the rim, something was wrong, and within 10 minutes, there'd be a guy there fixing the fucking net for us. I was a part of that. I learned that, so I could never be a hypocrite. But still, it opened up my eyes to a world that existed that a lot of other people, they don't get to see in life.
And it's very easy to be like, oh, well, corruption, all corruption's bad, every criminal is terrible, stuff like that. But it's like you're saying, like there's another side to it where, especially as kids, you don't know, it helps you out, or they're nice people, and you can't judge them like that.
I'm going to tell you that I knew everybody I dealt with and what they did. I'm going to tell you that, you know, I enjoyed being around Tati. I enjoyed being around. There was two factions to the corporation. There was the corporation, and then there were these guys that ran. They did their own thing. And I knew these guys that ran their own thing. That's who my mother's loyalty was. Juan, my stepfather, he was with a guy that was part of the corporation. He's not in this book. His name is Jose Tormil. They called him Nico. Nico had a lot of money and a lot of power, but he didn't have muscle. So he needed a guy like my stepfather. So he made my stepfather a partner to collect for him. At the same time, my stepfather became a loan shark. Because if Lee doesn't have the money, I'll loan it to you now so you could pay. It was a three-pronged operation. Oh. You understand me? So
that's
yeah,
a smart muscle.
They let you run numbers on credit. So you could play $215, $5, $614, $5. To correct people, to even understand what bolita and numbers are, it's the last three numbers of the paramutual of the track. So tomorrow morning when you wake up in Jersey or New York, open up the Daily News or the fucking New York Post, and you'll always see the paramutual of certain tracks. Aqueduct, Belmont, the one in Jersey, because that's the three last numbers. That's the bolita number. So it can't be messed with. It's based on the total profit of the track that day.
And that it sounds like it's like part of like almost like a religion, part
it's
of your culture.
It's part of your culture. You're growing up with numbers. Like one of the funniest things I ever heard was when I was a kid at the dry cleaner. some lady came in, and she goes, for some reason, and she was Cuban, and she was a friend of my mother's. And she goes, for some reason, I keep thinking of the number 33. And my mother goes, that's because your mother was a whore and she wore fake eyelashes. That's what 33 meant, that your mother was a whore and she wore fake eyelashes.
Oh, my God.
So all you had to do was put a prefix number on it, 5, anything from 1 to 9.
Yeah, but what if you made a mistake? Like, what if it was 33, but you picked 4 and it was 7? Like, would you get pissed off?
Yeah, you get pissed off because you didn't win no money.
So how do you pick that number?
You pick that number by, like, 604 was my mother's number. That was the last six. That was the last three numbers of my father's death certificate, or something. Something to do with my father. 517 was some other fucking lucky number she had. 219 she played. If she'd look up and there was a cop outside, cops always have a number on top of their car. 314, get the phone. Call Renee, tell them to put $5 on 314. You become addicted to those numbers, so those people collect at the end of the week, just like a sports bet.
It's 1,001?
And dog, I was always involved in it. Whew. From the time I was a kid, I knew it existed. I would go to the banks with my mother, and then my mother ran a bank in the Bronx when I was a kid. But later on was when I was when I went to Catholic school, there's a guy that called into the podcast once, Julio. He's my cousin of sorts. His brother and me, they used to call him Sandwich because he was fat. So they would call him Sandwich. Oh. And me and Sandwich on Saturdays would shoot into the Bronx or Brooklyn. Every Saturday it was a different designated area. And we would run numbers, 8, 9, 10, because these were the years I went to Catholic school, and I would come home on Saturdays and fucking run numbers. And on Sundays, I'd fuck around with my mom and then go back to the school and I'd work the bingo hall. So I was pulling down 100 a weekend in those days when I was 8 and 9. I'd make 100 a day running numbers, and I'd make about 50, 60 a night doing the bingo hall. Which, when you're a kid, that's a scam, dog.
It's a scam right now, 150 a day.
Yeah. I learned at an early age about how to run numbers, how to get tips from people when they hit the number.
See, that was the part I didn't understand, where you gave people, I mean, I guess your mom, yeah, but I would never give people a tip. Why do you give people a tip?
You always give people a tip because it's money in the karma bank. And you're giving him a yardstick tip. You might bump into 200 later. Last night I did something. I went somewhere and parking was 10 bucks. Already my blood pressure was high. But guess what? The guy had a hoodie on and a sweatshirt and he approached me like a gentleman and he spoke to me. And guess what he did? He gave me 2 5s. That means he did his homework. That's how you get a tip. So I gave him a 5. I went into the improv. What do they usually pay at the improv? $16, $22 for a set. They gave me a $50 bill. So I made his day, and then the improv made my fucking day. It all comes out in the wash at the end of the day. But holding on to that $5 or $10 to make somebody's day is going to make your time better tenfold. You're just putting 5 cents into the karma bank, bro.
I did take you never told me advice, but I always noticed that you tip very well when we're out at shows. So when I had that show last week in Santa Barbara, they were giving free drinks, and I gave the bartender 10 bucks, and her eyes lit up. And, like, it was I do notice that you do that. And
I learned at an early age. You go to a bar, there's 50 people at a bar, right?
Mm-hmm.
How do you get the bartender's attention? By giving her a dollar? No, open up with a 20. And look her in the face and go, I'm going to sit here for fucking 2 hours, and I don't want this thing to be empty. And guess what? When 100 people got their glasses out, guess who she's going to come to first?
That's true, you. Yeah.
It's business. Tipping is a part of business. You tip everybody you could tip, and you tip a little extra, and you make that day. Why? Because there's so many fucking people out there that are just cheap. That don't understand that people work for tips and you have to make their day. Whether it's a homeless guy, listen, I refuse to give money to homeless guys, but I got my little black bodyguard here in North Hollywood that every time I see him, I pull over and duke him a 20. You know what that's like, duking him a 20? I got my wife giving him 20, so now he knows what my wife looks like. So if shit gets danged down the corner, watch fucking Black Superman show up, the real Superman, and beat him up with his 19-inch dick.
I was going to say, do you have like a code word that you guys can scream if you need help or something?
Just fucking look at the situation. People like that are always watching those homeless people. I told you this a few weeks ago. I don't understand what people's cheapness is, especially when you have a credit card and you're paying with a credit card. If the thing says 15, 18, and 20%, and it tells you, I give them more than what it says on there. Because what we do, we're in the karma business. We're not in the cash business. We're in the karma business. We make somebody's day, and hopefully somebody makes our day every fucking day. And if you do that every day and you leave the house with that type of mentality, your life will be a lot fucking better. It really pans out for you. And that's for everybody who listens to this. Listen, like I said, I really enjoyed my conversation with TJ Inglis today. I was a little giggly. My heart was pumping because I love this guy. I would love to be a writer like him. I always dreamt of being Hemingway and drinking margaritas and writing about Cuba and passing out and shit like that. So today was a fucking pleasure for me. I hope you enjoyed it, and I hope you got something out of it. And don't forget to pre-order the book on Amazon. It's called The Corporation. They're going to write a movie. I mean, it's fucking going to be huge. Like I said to him, and I'm telling you, I'm really happy this guy opened up this avenue, especially with Narcos. You know, now it's time to tell this fucking story. So don't forget, Santa Ana Casino. Tickets only available for the 5th, which is a Thursday night at 7:30. I'll get you out of there by 9:30. And then fucking 420 weekend, motherfuckers. Columbus, Ohio. Like I said, I'm waiting on Netflix for an answer. I can't put together a tour till Netflix gives me an answer, and then I will be in your fucking town. And yes, I'm working on the fucking passport, all right? I love you, motherfuckers. Have a great day Monday. Don't forget, before I leave, I want to thank Onnit one more time for always having our back. They're a great supplement company. Like I said, I can't get you 10% off on
the bells
and the gorillas and all that shit, but I can get you 10% off on the supplements, whether it's the beef jerky, the protein powder, the Alpha Brain, the New Mood, the Shroom Tech Sport, which, brother, people fucking love. If you're involved in some type of athletic performance and you're not using Shroom Tech, you're missing the fucking boat. Go to Onnit.com right now and press in.
Church.
And get 10% off your order delivered right to your house. Number two, I love Squarespace. I love it. When they contacted me to do this, I can't do nothing. But on Squarespace, let me tell you something. If you're ready to start a business, make it stand out. Get started with Squarespace. I mean, because you think it, you dream it, you make it, and all this could be done with Squarespace. Right now, you're sitting there, you're thinking about your idea, but destiny is calling. It says you need a new website. Make it with Squarespace. All right, make it brighter and make it so it's a reality with the website from Squarespace. A dream is just a great idea that doesn't have the website yet. Think about it. Make it a reality with Squarespace. I mean, the reason why they do this, they do beautiful templates that create world-class designers and with a powerful e-commerce functionality that lets you sell anything online with the ability to customize the look, feel, settings, products, and more with just a few clicks. Everything is optimized for the mobile right out of the box, and it's a new way to buy domains and choose from over 200 extensions, okay? They also show you analytics that help you grow in real time with a built-in search engine optimization, free and secure hosting, and nothing to patch or upgrade ever, and 24/7 award-winning customer support. That's what Squarespace is about. So do me a favor. Head over to squarespace.com right now for a free trial when you're ready to launch, all right? Use the offer code CHURCH, CHURCH, to save 10% off your first purchase of a website or a domain. Who's helping you out today? Who's helping you reach your dream? Uncle Joey. But it starts with squarespace.com after you enter code CHURCH. Right now, you're going to showcase your work, and you're going to turn this idea that you've been burning into a website, all right? I love you guys with all my heart. Stretch it out. Don't quit before the miracle happens. I love you motherfuckers. See you Wednesday morning, and then I'll see you guys Wednesday night in NYAC, bitches. Have a great Monday. Stay black.
Ella era una mujer que a muchos hombres había engañado. Pero un día vino un hombre que con un beso la traicionó. Y ese hombre nunca había querido. Y por ese fue que Juana Peña lloró. Y dicen que los años como la nieve fueron pasando. Ella seguía llorando por ese amor que nunca